Hey everybody, sorry about that. It took a little couple of seconds for it to go live for me. Welcome to Friday Griscom stream. Hope everyone is doing pretty well. I just threw a beer can chicken on the smoker. I'm looking forward to that, so I have to monitor my temperatures as we're going. But I wanted to do one of these streams and chat with everybody just because we weren't able to get to everything we wanted to get to yesterday, and also to be sure to take your questions. So for folks who aren't familiar, these are a little bit more informal, just like to kick around a couple ideas with all of y'all. And I'm here to take super chat questions and also go through, a couple stories that I've had my eye on. Primarily, I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about Biden's plan, because yesterday during the show, we sort of went on at the exact same time as his announced plan. So maybe I'll start with that, but be sure to, jump in the chat and ask questions, and I will, do my best to answer them. And also, we very much appreciate, super chats here at Left Reckoning. But yeah, I mean, I think most of y'all probably have had a chance to at least check out the plan and its broad details, and, there's stuff in it that's pretty good. Some tax credits for needy families, increased funding, for COVID relief and vaccination, city and state funding, which has been just an unbelievable struggle to get the Republicans to agree to. So these are all things that are pretty decent in the in the plan. But of course, we're already getting a kind of preview of what it's going to be like dealing with the Biden administration in the way that they are now treating these $2,000 stimulus checks, which they are now saying they're just going to pay people $1,400. Instead of the 2,000 that they were running on in Georgia. So how do we want to take this? Here's the first top line thing about this. The plan is a little late would be an understatement, is extremely late. This is the kind of basic bare minimum plan that any functioning society would be providing to people on March 1st. So to provide this today is a bit of a joke. Now, we can have that analysis and also understand that it is incredibly critical that we get this through, that we fight to get it through, and we don't let the Democrats walk this back, because we've already been getting these echoings all week long before this plan was announced, that Biden is really gunning to get Republican support for this plan, which means they're going to attack all of these kind of, again, very basic. There's nothing radical or particularly revolutionary in this plan. There's nothing that's going to systemically change the United States economy, right? These are just to stop the bleeding, to take care of folks on the most basic level that a government should be doing. So any kind of compromise with the Republicans is a blow against you, working people, right? It's just like there's just no kind of compromise on this plan that can be accepted. And we need to make sure that, we're holding their feet to the fire on this, because I think what they would like to do is to say, like, oh, look, we put out this plan and the Republicans blocked it. Because I think that's going to be the strategy for the Biden administration over these next couple of years. But regardless, I think that it's a pretty decent plan. I think that there's a lot of ways we could go much further. But it's something that we definitely just need to push through Congress. No doubt about it. The walk back on the $2,000 is absolutely ridiculous, and people need much more money than that. They need that payment to be monthly. It has things like eviction moratorium until next September, which is just insane to me that we're sitting here in the middle of the crisis right now, and we are still actually having to debate whether or not we want to stop people from being kicked out of their home. And remember, too, these are moratoriums. They're not forgiveness. What we need across the board is debt forgiveness. So that's like the kind of basic line on the plan. And, I'm sorry. I think it's important for us to be responsible here and say that, like, okay, this is a decent plan. Let's move forward with it. But let's talk about the situation that we're in right now in this country. Just this week, there was another big spooky reaction just today by Wall Street, a big freak out. Why? Because early data that came out for December showed that retail, that U.S. retail data is under significant strain. Why does that matter? Because 2/3 of the United States economy, economic output, is in retail. And the fact that we didn't see growth, but instead actually saw losses, is an incredibly worrying sign for even the people at the top of the society. And it should be an even more worrying sign for people in our position. Well, what does a rational society do in a moment like that? They provide people with stimulus money as much as they possibly can, which is why it's absurd that Biden is walking away on the $2,000 checks that they ran on and had just massive public support. But then on top of it, what we really need is significant debt forgiveness, because what we've seen with these first few stimulus checks that have come out, people are using those to service their debts or to pay back, you know, back rent and things like that. If you are worried that the United States does not have enough, you know, consumer spending, right, because there isn't enough retail sales in this country, what do you need to do? Well, you need to meet people's longstanding needs so that they can take that money that they're getting and use it to buy stuff. Because what people are doing right now is they're taking that money and they're just using it to get debt collectors off of their back. That's the solution, is to forgive those debts, to eradicate those debts, to target those debts so that we can get things moving again. But again, that is the kind of more systemic change that the Biden administration and the centrist liberals are very allergic to, because they understand that a move like that fundamentally changes the relationship to people in their government, because it shows people, oh, wow, we can do a hell of a lot more than what we've been getting. Actually, there is a potential here for a transformative vision. So that's that's the kind of hot take, the general take on the Biden plan. I think we'll probably try to do some more in-depth stuff on it, but there's going to be no doubt that there's going to be a walk back, that we're seeing. I mean, like the fact that Biden brought in Jamie Harrison to run the DNC, I think really highlights that issue, that they're more interested in fundraising than governing and even winning. For people who aren't familiar, you know, Harrison ran in South Carolina. Everyone was very excited about it. It was going to be, oh, they're going to flip it. They're going to take the seat from Lindsey Graham. Well, you know, he loses by 11%, but breaks fundraising records. And that's what we're going to get from the Democratic Party, is a fixation on fundraising rather than winning and changing people's lives. Hold on one second. I have to respond to this. Apologize, y'all. But be sure to jump some questions in the chat. I'll take a couple of those. There's a couple more theoretical things I wanted to get to. Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, and Finn Bassin says, it reminds me of McGrath in Kentucky. I mean, McGrath was even, was an even more ludicrous example of that, because she had no chance in hell of winning, and they shut out in a fairly promising move for, different kind of politics. Not even necessarily saying that could have won, but it would have done a hell of a lot better and also would have built something interesting in the state of Kentucky. It's just like, this is the kind of fixation that we get from the Democratic Party. Well, let me see here, because there's a couple of more things I'd like to get to. The other big thing I wanted to talk to is some good news is we have more information from Alabama on the Amazon Union, which is a really exciting project, really exciting opportunity. We're going to be seeing a union vote, I think, on February 8th. So that's a really exciting moment. If people aren't familiar, that's a really exciting development, because there's going to be a big push there. And again, as I've been saying, it's like the Amazon unionization fight is something that could be incredibly transformative because of Amazon's role in basically becoming a monopoly power. Because it has such, especially in the pandemic, has such a hold on the way that most people are getting their goods in the U.S. economy, that creates a lot of opportunities. And last night, we had a great question from Kowalski talking about the potential of a trucker strike, which has the same kind of potential. So it's really exciting to see people organizing around getting a union recognized in Amazon, because that's the first step in these kind of larger fights. Comedian asks, wasn't there something positive in the bill about disabled workers' rights? I didn't come across that. I would be happy to see it, or happy to be pointed to it. I did see, there's going to be the $15 an hour increase, which again, it's just insane. I remember fighting for marching for $15 an hour in 2015, in all these cities where they just put in these like half-assed, slow rolling, move to increase the minimum wage. I mean, you know, it's amazing to me that we're still having that fight because we already need to push that number up. But that's an incredibly, you know, important fight, and that's going to help a lot of workers like that. And on top of it, I think there's also a fight. There's also a provision in the bill that Biden laid out to address the tip minimum wage, which I've been talking about a lot, which is just complete disaster, and has, you know, leads to really abusive relationships. And it's something that the Trump administration under their Department of Labor was targeting to attack workers, which was absolutely disgusting. But we have a comment here from Jordan who says, this is a really interesting issue for the establishment between keeping the economy going and allowing people to realize the government can do things. I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. I've been trying to point out to folks just the incredible difference between the way that the federal government responded for the needs of asset holders and the super wealthy in this country versus the way that they responded to, you know, the needs of normal people. What do I mean by that? I mean the fact that the Federal Reserve acted, which is historic agency and efficiency in pumping money into the private economy by doing things that they had never done before, much like they did in 2008. They were buying, in addition to all of the mechanisms that were developed in the 2008 crisis, they were buying corporate debt, which has exploded over the past few years. And basically what they did was they put a floor on corporate debt, which basically allowed corporations to continue to go into debt and to basically borrow extremely cheap rates, which has been a huge factor in the expansion of value on the stock market over this, over this COVID crisis, right? So you see that kind of action. That's not the only thing that the federal government did, but that's just one example. Additionally, things like the direct loans to businesses was a great example too. They were created these systems that didn't really work very well for small businesses, but worked very well for those kind of medium-sized businesses or businesses that had longstanding accounts with, you know, the major U.S. banks, to allow those people to be able to get, you know, significant loans as well. Just incredibly, sweeping ability to take care of those folks. When for us, it's like, people got a $1,200 check, and there's people who are still trying to fight to get that in, right? Because they still haven't got it. I mean, there's so many people who fall through the cracks, and it's just a great example of the deficiency of the U.S. government to provide stimulus to people because all those taps have been shut off. Eric, comrade Eric says, did you see Bernie is pressuring Biden to universalize healthcare during COVID? Obviously narrow, but maybe a taste of universal healthcare will be the catalyst we need. I think that's a great idea. I think it's absurd that we're sitting in this moment right now. People are acting like, you know, debating and fighting for Medicare for all is something that should be off the table. I think that the way that we do that is really important. I think Bernie Sanders is showing a phenomenal way of doing that. As Eric says, you give people a taste and it really opens up doors, because Biden's running against Medicare for All was I think politically stupid, but also even more importantly, morally disgusting. It was politically intelligent because Biden is just a pure creature of the DNC. And I think people need to understand this too, that Biden is much more deeply rooted in the DNC than even Obama was. So, you know, Biden running against Medicare for All was making sure that they understand the kind of politician that he is. Not that they had any doubts before, but that's him basically playing his role as their boy, their number one boy, right? But I think Bernie Sanders using this opportunity to expose what could actually be done that would be radically different is a perfect example of the kind of politics that we need to be seeing. So I'm 100% excited about that. Someone says, do you think the moving the 2000 to 1400 might just be to keep the budget under 2 billion? An incredibly stupid reason to do it, but I can see that mattering to Biden. Trillion. I've made the same mistake as you. I don't think so. I think that's it's a funny idea though. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I also wanted to mention this too to folks. You need to understand that Biden is going to do politics with this. And what I mean by that, he's going to be playing games. The fact that we were getting all of these inside reporting during the last negotiation, that Biden was basically the force behind the $600 checks instead of the $2,000 checks, right? That was revealed in the New York Times, where they said people, who were privy to the negotiations said that because Biden had basically assured both Republicans and Democrats that he wouldn't come at them for supporting a $600 check, they felt more comfortable voting for, you know, this much smaller bill. Why did he do that? It's politics. It was Georgia. They wanted to be able to run on 2000 at the end in Georgia. They wanted to push that. They didn't want for this to be not, it wouldn't be settled, obviously, but they didn't want people to think, oh, something got done, and something got done maybe by Trump and the Republicans, right? Politics, the way they do it is a game. I'm not even going to talk about that strategy, what works there. It's a moral question. And it should be revealed to you that in that moment, this was not somebody who was advocating to make sure that people could get the best deal possible, that people could be helped out as much as possible. This is somebody who was making political calculations. And when we go into this debate with the Republican Party, we, it's the wrong word, but when you see the Democrats go into this debate with the Republican Party, you need to understand that those Democrats are going to go into it with those kind of political calculations where they will accept something knowing that it is not, you know, the best move, and that it will actually could definitely hurt people, right? That's the reality of the situation that we're in. And that's why we can't sort of walk away. This is why we can't just sit here and say, like, okay, Trump's done, the game's over. I mean, this is time to zero in on the Democratic Party and their wickedness, and to start building our own kind of political movements that can challenge them. And I'm going to get into it, I think, a little bit later. The title of this video is something I called You Can't Have a Party Without the People. And I'll get into that in a second. But before I do that, I want to make sure I'm here for Super Chat questions. And also, I want to talk a little bit about the Alphabet Union, because we had promised to do that yesterday. And for people who were listening to the post game yesterday, they probably already heard a good bit of this. But I just wanted to go over it again. Really exciting moment that we've seen, is that workers at Alphabet, Google's parent company, all these cheesy names that they come up for themselves. Anyways, workers there are organizing, and they're working to form a union. And I believe, you know, it's somewhere around 600 members last I checked, and that might have been like 3 or 4 days ago. So who knows what the numbers are now. That's very exciting. That's a really exciting development. And I think most people listening to this understand why this is an exciting development, but there has been some pushback or some worries about the union. And I just wanted to make a couple quick notes as to why. Why are people worried about a union at Amazon? I mean, sorry, at Google. People were worried because they are using a wall-to-wall strategy where they're going to be including workers from all different parts of Google, including like the blue-collar workers whose labor actually makes that system a function, along with people who, you know, make maybe higher salaries and have significant benefits, you know, people who work in AI or coders, things like that, right? They want to have a union that is encapsulating all of these different people, which I think is a great strategy. And I think is something that is really important and is the kind of, you know, left movement that I want to see going forward. But people are worried, one, because of how anti-union Google is, about, you know, one, the retribution, the attacks that people might face from the company, and the fact that, Google has incredible surveillance capabilities to spy on their own employees. But the group of people who were the most critical going into it were worried that what you were going to see from the Google union, because those workers, some of them, and I think that's really important, like one of the biggest difference in Google is between like full-time workers and like contract workers, people who are considered to be full-time employees and people who aren't, right? classic system in American capitalism today, right? By the way, thank you so much, Modular Mammoth. I love all y'all's usernames for the super chat there. But, you know, people were really, you know, there's some people out there who were saying that there's going to be there because people might not be fighting necessarily for like higher wages for themselves, that what was going to happen was that the union was just going to be, you know, a culture union, you know, the kind of like kind of PMC politics. And I don't think that that's 100% outlandish to consider for a moment, but I think that is a really silly reason to be negative about this process, right? I can see 100% if you get a certain kind of a group of people, especially if it's a small union, then it just becomes, you know, an organ for kind of internal like company politics, right? For people who want sort of, you know, significant changes. And by the way, I think it's really important to mention like, you know, like good changes, but like HR kind of changes in their office, right? And it basically just becomes like an employee pressure group, you know, for certain folks, right? You know, that was the kind of criticism that we were getting from people. But I would argue this, that one, if it does that, then it won't be particularly effective and we'll just forget about it. Two, we shouldn't subtract those kind of fights necessarily from the labor movement. I think that's an absurd position to take. But three, and most importantly, building worker power is going to mean pulling in lots of different people from different backgrounds and also from different economic situations, right? And the only way we're going to overcome those differences is by getting people into the same place and starting to have those conversations and fights and understandings that you get when you are in combined struggle. So what you would need to see there is for people who do have a nice situation, you know, who are sort of more entrenched in the company, have higher benefits and things like that, be willing to show solidarity with, you know, the drivers and the cooks and the janitorial staff, right? That's the kind of development that will need to happen. But that development will never happen until you start having people joining into an organization together, right? So that is just something that it's like, if it that doesn't happen, then it will fail, right? So saying that there's a kind of challenge and there's a difficulty potentially coming forward is no reason to be negative. So I think that, you know, the position 100% should be full solidarity. Let's do this fight. And even beyond that, that criticism, which is the one that I heard the most, at least from people who I respect and listen to, the other criticism of the Google union was not coming from people like that. It was coming from morons who were saying things like, oh, why do these privileged workers need a union, right? Amazing to me how quick our right-wing opponents are to, by the way, pick up the privilege discourse when it suits their fight against people trying to better their lives. I'll make the argument for why we should want a stronger union at Google and for those people to be represented and to be militant. Well, Google is an incredibly powerful corporation. In fact, one that, you know, I interact with regularly. But beyond that is a corporation that is owning more and more and more of our digital spaces, the products that we use, and has incredible powers in surveillance and also in just knowledge storage, like storing knowledge for all of these, you know, different things that we're using, right? Google has become very much integral to the American way of life and also, you know, a lot of other countries as well, right? Do you want for a second there not to be a check on that kind of power from the, you know, from the executives of that company? Do you not want those people who are in that organization, you know, more rank and file workers there to be able to say, you know what, this doesn't sound right. I don't think I want to do that. You want people in that position to not feel like they have to run out and be a whistleblower and hope that they can get public opinion to shift. And then maybe we could get the government, you know, to come in and regulate these companies that donate, you know, millions of dollars to all of these politicians. No, you want somebody who's saying, wait, I think this product that we're creating, or I think the way that they're planning on using this is unethical or wrong, or it might harm people. I'm going to talk to my union brothers and sisters, my coworkers, my other union members about addressing this and demanding that they shift this, right? I want people within that organization to have the ability to challenge the leadership on the way that they're using those tools and using all of this data. That's just a basic question of democracy, right? So drop all of the other stuff. I really want there to be the power for people in that organization to be able to challenge that system if they feel, you know, that it's needed, right? Because I think, you know, we make fun of tech people a lot on, excuse me, that was my grill. we make fun of, you know, people who work at Silicon Valley a lot in the show. And like, I think it's worthwhile to, you know, to mess with some people who are full of themselves. But I think that there has become a little bit too much of a caricature of those folks. You know, a lot of these people are very skilled folks who are interested in building the technology and the future that, you know, in the next, the building the future that we're going to enter into, building the technology and the tools that we're going to, you know, be using, right? There is nothing about that, that is negative, right? The problem that we make on a political economic argument is that system, and particularly Silicon Valley, has too much political and economic power in our society. We want that change, right? But we shouldn't look at people who are working in tech as like enemies of the working class movement. In fact, most of these people are workers themselves, right? They should 100%, you know, be included in that. And a lot of these people go into tech and to these kind of jobs, not because some of them do, but not all of them. Go into it not because they're like, oh, I need to make, you know, an incredible sum of money. They go into it because, wow, I really like working with computers, and I think I have, you know, a few ideas of, you know, things that we can build, right? That's the kind of general human spirit that 100% I want to be included on the left. So I think that, you know, I think that the Google union is something that we 100% should be supporting. All right, y'all. Well, I don't want to go on too long because I have to go and check on the grill, but I wanted to expand a little bit on what I mean by you can't have a party without the people. Because I think that, and this is something I'm just going to take a stab at it now. I'll do something more in depth on this later, but I talked a little bit last night in the post game about Leo Panitch, who is a personal favorite of mine, a really important theorist and somebody who unfortunately passed away, somebody whose work you should definitely check out and take a deep dive into as, you know, as soon as you can. He is incredibly accessible as a political theorist. He was the real deal, not just an incredible theorist and intellectual, but a real fighter. And reading his work is very interesting to do in 2021 because we're at this moment where we have just come out of like the exuberance of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and all these other left movements that seemed like, oh, wow, we're at the precipice of power. And now we're on the other side and like neoliberalism is ascendant. You know, Joe Biden's coming in. He's going to put down, you know, the plan they should have done in March. He's going to put the plan they should have done in March in today and act like it's going to be some big victory for the American people, right? It's a joke, the kind of politics that we're going to be seeing from centrists and from liberals, and the return of this kind of technocratic class into power is something that is very worrying, right? So we're sort of on this other side of, you know, essentially this disappointment. And I want to, you know, provide a couple of warnings, you know, that I can get from Leo Panitch's work, particularly with his long view of being involved in studying and covering left-wing movements, particularly democratic socialist movements. And one of his important insights about why this moment that we're living through is really exciting is because we are moving from protest to politics. What do we mean by that? For a really long time, people in the West took this absurd position that class politics was a dead end, right? That because one of the failure of the Soviet Union and two, you know, increased standards of living and things like that, that basically the socialist vision was no longer needed. That, we've learned, was a huge mistake, hollowed out politics, and has allowed the right wing to flourish all across the country, all across the globe, and has led to just a complete devastation of working class standards of living in the West and across the globe as well, right? That was a mistake. And then you started to see in the 80s and 90s in the left a subtle return to class, but also just completely painted in cultural fights, right? And then you just had this idea essentially like an anarchist idea. And I mean this in the kind of most general sense, not in the stupid sense that like people at CNN would call anybody who like is against the government anarchist. I mean, in the sense like people who are just like extremely allergic to any kind of like hierarchy or just like touching state power, right? This anarchist idea that we could have power without politics, basically that the left could serve as just a pressure group and we never needed to come into power because we could just protest our way to get what we want. That culminated, you know, in the protests against globalization in the early 2000s. And I think most vividly in my life, I'm sure in a lot of y'all's, in Occupy. You know, and Occupy was a really important moment for me. That's where when I really dug deep into the left and became active in protest movements and organizing in protesting and all these things. And you realize that this retreat from politics and retreat, particularly from class politics, had been exceptionally damaging to the left, because basically you were able from time to time to get everybody at the same meeting or the same protest, but they would go away pretty quickly, right? You didn't have that viability. And also we didn't have the power to be able to demand what we wanted. We could make a show and maybe influence public opinion, maybe influence the opinion of some politicians, but it was not long lasting enough to do the kind of transformative work that we have to do to fight years of neoliberalism and now centuries of capitalism, right? Like that work is serious, and it's not something that we're going to be able to, you know, fight back against, which is, you know, kind of spontaneous, you know, activities. So what happened over this past decade is we had the move from protest to politics. You saw that first with Syriza, which was an incredibly inspiring moment for people across, you know, across Europe and also, you know, socialists in the United States, because we saw, you know, the union of the radical left coming into power, challenging the EU, challenging globalization. And we're going to get to the issues that happened with Syriza in a second, right? But I'm just sort of going over the history very briefly for people who aren't familiar, because I think a lot of times, and especially people who are like younger socialists, and what I mean by that, people who like got active through like Bernie Sanders might not be familiar with like the big things that were exciting to folks a few years ago. So like at the beginning of the last decade, Syriza was like the hope of the left, right? That they were going to be, you know, the new kind of politics, right? They came into power in Greece, which has been devastated by neoliberal policies in the EU. And they were basically going to fight back and, you know, challenge the system. For folks who aren't familiar, but with Syriza, you might be familiar with Yanis Varoufakis, you know, the great economist, now leading DiEM25, and I believe also the Progressive International, right? He was their finance minister and was going into meetings with the, you know, with the EU, but essentially Germany. And he's great. You know, has all these good one lines. It's like, it's the first time I was in negotiations with, you know, creditors who didn't want to get paid back. okay. So that's Syriza. And then we saw Podemos, right? Which was another kind of exciting movement. Though I will say, you know, slightly different, just because a lot of what you saw in Podemos and the leadership was this fixation on what was called left populism. And that's a word, I've done some streams on TMBS on left populism. I'm going to have to do them again on this platform. When you think of populism in the United States, and when I say left populism in Europe, particularly regarding Podemos, very different kind of concepts, right? Because there's the populism as like the actually historical political movement. And then there's left populism, which was a theory that was developed by Chantal Mouffe and Ernesto Laclau, right? Primarily in a book called Hegemony and Social Strategy, where they did this radical break from Marxism. They did this, they saw, and you got to give them credit for it, because I'm very critical of this theory, by the way, but they did see the way that politics was going. They saw that you could replace class with culture and with all of these other ideas, all these other signifiers And they argued essentially that that was the way for the left. So no more doing the class politics. Instead, you know, find marginal groups, marginal peoples, and try to unite them all, you know, through chains of equivalence, right? And you can see why that's an attractive theory, because, you know, the argument there is that you're pulling in all of these different groups, and then you're able to basically, you know, create the broad front, you know, that wins in the end. The problem with this perspective, the problem with this movement, is that without class politics, you lose the working class. And as I said last night, and this is a line from Leo Panitch that I'm trying to, you know, that I'm getting back to now, that parties play a big role in the class consciousness of classes in general, but in particular, the working class. Like, socialist parties have played an incredibly important historical role in helping people become class conscious. But also parties were developed because people were coming together and becoming conscious of themselves as members of a class. The problem with a kind of politics that rejects like class as like the main category for how they're going to engage with this system is, one, you get kind of sloppy reformism, right? As we've seen, neoliberalism is just as skilled at incorporating radical demands for change into their program. What do we mean by that? I mean, was it Chase Bank? You know, that was doing those ads with D. Ray McKesson, you know, during Black Lives, you know, during the early Black Lives Matter protests. Like, these corporations are very, very skilled at being able to incorporate some of these more radical demands for social change into their program, right? They do it in a watered down way because they don't want to challenge the fundamental structures of capitalism. And, you know, these systems, you know, racism and sexism, things like that, are fundamental baked into that system of capitalism. But they're able to do a kind of a version of that. And if you lose that class analysis, then it's very easy for you to be led astray. On top of that, breaking from a class politics, you forget the whole reason why socialism is such an important, socialism and Marxism and communism have been such important forces in history. People oftentimes think that the reason that Marx wrote about the working class was because Marx and socialists think that the working class is the most oppressed in society. That's not the case, right? Working class people are oppressed in society, but they're not necessarily the most oppressed in society. You know, there are people who are outside of the workforce who face horrible abuses. Like, there are things that are worse than having to go to a job every day, right? And it's amazing to me that people don't understand when socialists say that we need to focus on class, that they're not saying no other struggles matter. The reason that Marx and socialists think that the working class is incredibly important to politics is because this system is dependent on the labor of the working class. The only way that these wheels continue to turn is because working people across the globe continue to make them run with their labor. Understanding that means that the working class understands that they have the leverage and the potential to change this system, because in the working class, there is the radical revolutionary potential of the eradication of class difference in general, right? That's why class politics are important. And that's why any kind of move that pulls away from class politics has turned, unfortunately, you know, to not be very effective. And Podemos has done good work, and I'm not trying to dog on them, but we've seen them now going into coalition in Spain turn on a lot of the more radical positions that they had. We saw, unfortunately, even with Syriza, that a lot of the people who had been longtime politicians weren't willing to take the bold move when the European Union basically said, we're going to cut off the taps if you don't implement more austerity. And what happened with Syriza? Syriza implemented more austerity because their hands were tied, right? There's no doubt about it. But because their hands were tied, they implemented more austerity, and now they're out of politics. And even worse than the austerity that has been given to the Greek people because of that loss, the worst part about that is now the left is blamed for it. So those are some lessons from, you know, before the Bernie Sanders and the Corbyn moment. And now we're in a, you know, a situation where we thought we were coming into power with Bernie, and that didn't come into play. And Corbyn found out that the Labour Party was so much more committed to neoliberal capital, to making sure that it was presenting itself as a party that is safe for bankers, that that it would not, that it would actually purposefully lose elections, that members of its own party would undermine and sabotage the leadership, ensuring more Tory rule, by the way. And, you know, and just like, honestly, it's disgusting to think about the amount of deaths that you could pin on those Labour Party members who backstab Corbyn because they wanted to make sure that they could go on book tours after election. They wanted to make sure that when they went into the city, when they went into the high society, that they would be accepted as members of the elite instead of standing up for the working class, right? There was an underestimation of the commitment of those organizations to neoliberal capitalism. So what is to be done is what the title of this video is. You won't have the party until you have the people. What we have to do right now is convince people that politics can change their life. What do I mean by that? We have to show people that there is a horizon that can be reached, and the only thing that is stopping us from reaching that is our system. Why is that important, and why is that different from the other kind of politics that we have seen achieve incredible successes, but also limitations? The difference is that we need to understand that we can't do protest instead of politics. But we also can't do politics without having the people. We have to be able to play in the halls of power. And we also need to have social bases that are willing to flex our power in the real economy and in the streets to make the things that we want to happen happen. So to build a left movement that is actually going to be viable and is going to be able to change people's lives, we have to start doing the work. As socialists, as people in communities, as people with family members, as people who have friends around you, we need to start doing the work of letting people understand that we all have many different aspects of our lives. We have many different interests, backgrounds, ethnicities, you know, all these things, right? And those are all incredibly important. But there is one thing that we share, and that is that we are all workers. And when people start recognizing themselves as oppressed workers, the political calculus will begin to change. The political relationships will begin to change. People who are members of different parties, different tendencies and things like that, if they can start thinking themselves, not just as individuals, but as members of a, not just a community, like a world's historical force, members of a people who know no borders and know no time, right? If they can recognize themselves as people in this long arc of history and act in accordance with that through political organizations and social organizations, there's no limit to what we can do. Now, to take this down, you know, from the clouds for a second, what that actually means is people going out and doing the real work of helping people understand their conditions and also building these social and political spaces that have been missing. And there are lots of organizations that have been trying to do that work. You know, from organizations like the DSA to organizations like the Socialist Alternative. And I think that work needs to continue to be supported. We have to be, we have a really incredibly difficult job because our goal isn't just to win elections, it's to change an entire system, right? That's not something that's going to happen overnight, but it's also something that's not going to take decades to do. I don't like this kind of argument that people say is like, oh, you know, in two generations, maybe we can get some basic social democracy. Like, the world changes very quickly, but we need to start thinking more practically about this thing and how we're doing politics, and not thinking that ourselves as individual, just proclaiming ourselves as the most radical is going to change to anything. Because you know what? There have been radicals across the globe and in this country for generations who have done really important work. And, you know, and we should recognize that. But also, just being radical in itself doesn't change the world around you, right? What you need is to be in organizations, to be to be fighting as members of a class and participating and thinking about politics in that way. That's the next step that we have to do. Like, the Bernie Sanders moment was really exciting because we had something, an activity, a movement, and an idea that we could rally behind in very concrete steps. Donate, advocate, volunteer, vote, right? Like, that's what the Bernie Sanders, you know, move was for a lot of people. Now we actually are in this moment. It's like, okay, we tried that. We did a lot. We brought a lot of people into this. A lot of people think about politics differently. But there are also a lot of people who still just don't believe, not just in the message, but there's a lot of people who are depressed. I mean this quite seriously. We have a class depression in this country. Working class people, they vote defensively or they don't participate in politics at all because they think that politics is only a negative. It's only going to hurt them. And we need to show people that these are vehicles that can change their conditions. And we also need for people to understand that participating in, you know, union activities in organizations is also an incredibly beneficial activity to engage in. We have to build the people before we can have the party. We have to build the people before we can have the party. We have to build this kind of consciousness before we can have the party. That's how it has always worked in history, because it's not that people don't believe in ideas or that they won't be convinced if you talk to them about, oh, you know, it would be better for universal healthcare, things like that. They don't think it can happen. And until we can build the kind of organizations that show people that, like, actually, you know, there's a lot more like-minded people in your community than you think, right? And here are some activities and avenues that we have to build that kind of power, right? That's the task of our time. And I think it's really important to try to get involved in a tenants organization, in the DSA, in local organizations to start to build that power, not just fixating on building local power, organizing locally to build nationally, right? Let me see. I hope that was of interest to y'all. A lot of people don't trust their unions. What can we say to them? I mean, do you mean that they don't trust the unions or they don't trust their unions? I'm sorry. I know you're not on the other end of the line. I mean, you know, I think that most people should, I think that we have historical arguments about what's happened as unionization rates in this country have dropped. We have seen the standard of living of working people in this country drop, right? You know, I think that that's like the kind of general basic argument. If you are a member of the union and you don't trust your union, that's the moment that you start doing organizing with other members, you know, on your level who can, you know, challenge the leadership. Because, look, there is a problem with union leadership in this country, right? And, you know, we have to fight and develop that. I don't think that those are things that can't be overcome. Jordan says, I find a decent motivation to give people to have these conversations in their social environment is that it straight up enriches your relationships. I think so too. I mean, I also think that once this damn pandemic is over, that we should hit the ground running with continuing the work. And I always want to make sure to always say continuing the work, because there are people who are doing this work, and it gets me frustrated. People act like, you know, no one's out there trying to do this kind of stuff. You know, continuing the work of building political organizations, but also ones that have a bit of sociability to them, because we have lost that in this country, and COVID in particular has really stifled that as well. How can we bridge the gap between DSA people who want to feel and care their way into the future and the working class? Well, I mean, I think if the point there is a culture difference, I think, you know, look to DSAs, for example, like the Austin DSA, which has done a pretty good job of including more traditional working class communities in their fights and their organizing. But I would also say internally in DSA, you know, there's two things. I think one, people need to stop being so down all the time on this. I think the fact that people are joining a socialist organization is a good thing. And if it's not the kind of perfect imaginary of what a socialist organization looks like, I think the answer is to, you know, continue doing the kind of work and organizing. If you're talking about people who are in the DSA who are making the mistake of doing what I was calling the Chantal Mouffe, you know, or Ernesto Laclau, like left populism, it's a political organization, it's a democratic one. That's a moment that you have to do that kind of challenge. Let me see. I want to make sure I can grab a couple of these questions. I really appreciate everybody in the chat, you know, so much. It means a lot to us. Yeah, and like, and you know, our friend Erican says, you know, there's some DSA groups that are in the clouds. There is no doubt about it. And there are also some that are very like built in and on the ground kind of work. Like, that's just the reality of it. I'll also say, like, a good example of that is this. You know, people get frustrated with AOC, and I get frustrated with AOC as well, right? You know, one difficult aspects of AOC is that we have a political movement that is creating elected officials, but does not have the ability, because we don't have that kind of strength in our membership organizations that, you know, basically you elect somebody like AOC and she's more powerful, unfortunately, than the DSA in the current iteration. What's the solution to that? I think, you know, one, like, friendly critique is worthwhile engaging in. But two, if you have any problems with AOC, the solution is more AOCs. Right. What do I mean by that? It's like, if you think AOC represents a very particular kind of person, you know, a New York, you know, person, a young millennial who's like, you know, thinks and talks in a certain way, and you want like socialist left wing politics to be represented by a different kind of character. Well, the answer is to get those characters into power. Like, not like people spend too much time fixating about AOC and like her actions and the way that she talks. And like, I mean, like, I'm not saying don't criticize her. I'm not saying don't think about her as a member, you know, as a political representative. That's not what I'm saying at all. But like, there's so much like magnifying on her, which like what people were essentially saying is like, man, I wish that we had, you know, different kind of representatives. And it's like, well, I think so too. And let's build that. I want to see, you know, more, you know, working class like Southern folks leading these kind of, you know, political movements as well. The answer, though, is not to freak out and get worked up about AOC all the time, because you just like, it's a fool's errand and just like you're going to waste your time and your energy on that. You know, the answer is to build more power, to get more people in there so that we don't have to fixate on like the lone democratic socialist or one of the few democratic socialists in Congress, right? That's my position. That's been my position on that. Yeah, y'all. I really actually would like to keep going, but I had only intended to do about 45 minutes. Mason asks a good question, though. I think this is a good one to sort of wrap up on. What is the difference between a workers' party and a political party? A workers' party is a socialist party. It's a party that is of and for workers. A political party, you know, obviously can encapsulate all these different kind of you know, any kind of political party, obviously. I think to think more strategically, and I think to get to your question more, it's like, you know, the Democratic Party is a political party. It's not a workers' party. We can use some of the ballot lines where it is advantageous to us right now until we have the strength to build a workers' party. You know, but we should never think about the Democratic Party as a workers' party. I would also say that some people who are trying to build third parties that are presenting themselves as more like they're the progressive party and not socialist parties, I would say those are political parties and not workers' parties either. I think it's really important, actually, to start being really clear that if you're a socialist, you're trying to build workers' power, socialist power, working class power. Thanks, Mike, for, you know, socialist power, instead of, you know, just a kind of general, like, squishy concepts. I think the time for squishy concepts has been shown to be disastrous. We've gone through what I would call, in general, left populism. And again, this is why sometimes it's hard to talk instead of writing, because I don't want people to get the wrong when I'm talking about populism. I am a big supporter of, you know, the historical populist party in the United States. I think that's an incredible model, an incredible moment in history. I'm talking about left populism as this kind of decentering of class and trying to put class with a bunch of different other kind of signifiers so that it's not a socialist party. It's just a progressive party, which, again, a progressive party is preferable to the Democratic Party or any of the political organizations that we have right now. But that is fundamentally different from a workers' party. What is a workers' party's end goal? A workers' party's end goal is to fight in the interest of the working class. What is the interest of the working class? To eradicate the system of capitalism and to build a socialist future. That is a very different politics than a progressive someone who might call themselves a progressive, who might just want to tweak capitalism to make it fair, right? Workers' parties have a very different kind of logic and particularly a very different end goal. I would also say, that they also have more strategic commitments where they're not just going to be ultra leftists because this is a real fight for them, not just a kind of fantasy or a game. They're very worried about getting things like higher wages and Medicare for all and these kind of non-reformist reforms that we can get under capitalism while building a socialist future in the future. Milton Turtle asks, and I think I'm gonna have to roll out. And he makes it. Yeah, I will just say one thing. It's like, what's one thing that we can do to move towards prison abolition? Abolition. I think the most practical thing you can do is, again, one, to educate yourself, but two, to participate in political organizations. I mean, really, it's like the answer to most of these questions goes in the same way, in the same direction. It's like, we're not going to be able to get these things until we build the power to take them for ourselves. All right, y'all, I actually really have to go make sure my food's okay. But one day I'll do some good, barbecue vids for all of y'all. I really appreciate everybody. I'll try to come up and maybe do this again next week, because I actually think there's a lot more to get to that we weren't able to jump into. Again, if you are able to or interested, you can find our work at Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. I'm always available for messages or questions on Twitter or email or through our Patreon. So, feel free to reach out anytime. Hope everyone has a great weekend, and talk to you all soon. Bye.